Okay, our topic for tonight is post-Herzlian Zionism. Herzl dies July 3rd, 1904. Upon his demise, Baruch Dynamis. Many people attended his funeral, and he was considered a hero. There was Herzl. There was some talk about publishing his diaries in the immediate aftermath of his death. And Max Nordau said, "Don't do it. If you publish it now, people will think he was a dreamer and a swindler because he accomplished nothing and took everybody's money." In other words, that's the state of play of political Zionism in 1904, that there had been no major breakthrough, that although he had pursued a policy of engagement with the heads of state and had had meetings with major players like the Kaiser and the Sultan and various foreign ministers, including even in Russia, still the charter that he had wanted to secure, which would guarantee Jewish rights and possibly statehood in some corner of the world, was not achieved. And Herzl was an exclusively political Zionist, as opposed to other types of Zionism. And after his death, it's going to be a question, what type of Zionism is going to win the day in this movement? So, this big issue comes to a head in 1905 at the 7th Congress. The question of Uganda, or British East Africa, was still ostensibly on the table. Now, the truth of the matter is the British had really walked away from that proposal. But from a Jewish perspective, as a theoretical matter, it was still there. Are we pursuing Zion, meaning Palestine, only? Or are we pursuing a refuge somewhere in the world? And the Zionite Zionists, the Tzionei Tzion, the ones who were devoted to the cause of Eretz Yisrael, who were mostly the Russian Eastern European types, they won the day. And the defeated party became known as the Territorialists. And they left the Zionist organization. And under the auspices of Israel Zangwill, they established the ITO, the Jewish Territorial Organization. For 12 years, Zangwill's organization meandered about looking for somewhere on the planet to plop down the Jews and create a state for them. But it failed. They never made any progress. They went out of business in 1917. Why? Because the Balfour Declaration made it a moot point. That Tzion Eitz Zion turned out to be right. That one spot on earth really was going to be Eretz Yisrael. And the charter that Herzl had long hoped for basically was given. Now, truth be told, and we'll get to Balfour in a few weeks, it's nowhere near the kind of guarantee that Herzl was hoping for. The Balfour Declaration is a very mealy-mouthed, watered-down statement when you actually read it carefully. But it meant that where is this movement, this Jewish national movement, going to find its spot on earth? Eretz Israel. So the territorialists, in hindsight, were like a blip on the radar who made a mistake. They didn't get it right. But let's ignore them for the moment.
It was indefinite, though. It did not give a specific year for its fruition.
Implementation, correct. And the nature of the British mandate's relationship to the Jews is a complicated one we'll spend 3 months discussing. So, back to the Zionists, what type of Zionism exists? Well, there are three types. There's political, which says, and this is the Herzlian type, that we're going to focus on statecraft, on diplomacy, and we're not going to spend one penny on those little settlements in Israel until such time as the world powers guarantee our rights in some international forum. So not even one penny on Yishuvim, absent political guarantees. That's the Herzlian approach. The problem in 1904, 1905, is that approach is bankrupt. Not in the literal sense, in the metaphorical sense. It's gained nothing. It's wasted 8 years of effort. And there are other things that can be done. So why put all your eggs in a basket that seems to be a failure? Now, the other option is practical Zionism. What is practical Zionism? Another cow, another goat, another house, another building. In other words, little by little, you invest a shekel here, a shekel there, we'll build up Eretz Yisrael. How does that differ from Chibat Zion? To be honest, it doesn't. Practical Zionism is the real successor of Chibat Zion. Herzl was a reformation, so to speak, a revolution, a radical one, saying, let's talk politics. But practical Zionism is, let's build up the Yishuv, and even though we don't have any guarantee from the Sultan about the political future of this community, we'll make it bigger and bigger, and this is another important point, the practical Zionists were of the view, and they were 100% right, that there is political value to small-scale settlement. Because in the absence of small-scale settlement, you can't have medium-scale or large-scale. You have to start small. And eventually, the authorities will care about the facts on the ground. It will no longer be a matter of an abstraction. The facts on the ground will matter. Of course, in the 1930s and 1940s, this proves to be entirely correct. Why is there a state of Israel? There's a state of Israel because there were 600,000 Jews in Palestine and they couldn't be ignored. If people were waiting around for political guarantees and the yeshuv was not gradually built up, this never would have come to pass. Okay. So that's the practical school. Most of the Eastern Europeans were practical types. Most of the Western Europeans were political types. What's the third school of Zionism? Cultural Zionism. Cultural Zionism of a Chara'am variety says we need to give the Jews of the diaspora nationalist sentiment and fervor. Because if they don't have it, then it doesn't matter that we'll send a handful of people to Israel and they'll struggle to be farmers. Our nation will not be ready for its ultimate destiny. So you have to do work in the present. Gegenwartsarbeit in German. Work in the present of Hebrew language and nationalist agitation in the Chutz La'aretz. So these are the three different types of Zionisms. Well, when we get to the partification, the parties within Zionism, which we'll discuss in 3 minutes, I'll get to religious Zionism first. But on the broad scale of the varieties of Zionism, before we get to party, you have political, practical, and cultural. If you combine them all together, you get synthetic Zionism. Synthetic Zionism, as it is now known, and it's been known for 75 years, to be honest, in the scholarly literature. Synthetic Zionism is a combination of all three. It says, even though the political angle hasn't worked thus far, we can't completely ignore it. We have to continue to pursue it going forward, but with lesser expectations, not with Herzlian grandiose expectations. We have to pursue the practical, because if there's no practical, then there's nothing. We actually have to have people on the ground in Israel. And you need the cultural, because if you don't have the cultural, you won't have the reservoir of people going forward who will want to go to Israel. I mean, people need a motivation. And if they haven't been building up towards it, you know, who goes nefesh b'nefesh, aliyah, the folks from the five towns in Teaneck, people who've been in Bnei Akiva for the last 30 years. If they didn't have the Bnei Akiva, they didn't have the day schools where they learn Hebrew, they wouldn't go on nefesh b'nefesh. So you need to have the diaspora agitation to make it possible for people to eventually go. All right, so you have all three is synthetic. Who will take over the movement officially? Who's going to be the president? Herzl's dead. So nobody could replace him and be a one-man operation with the gravitas that Herzl had. That was not going to happen. They were not going to find such a person. Herzl's number one supporter among the Western European assimilated Jews who founded the Zionist organization in 1897 was Max Nordau. But Nordau said to himself and then to others, I can't be the guy, for a few reasons. Number one, I live in Paris, and Paris is an out-of-the-way place in terms of Zionist activity. Vienna was a central area, even Berlin, certainly Russia, but in Russia it's illegal, so you can't do it. But Paris is too far west. It's not a good place to be the headquarters. Secondly, I was a Dreyfusard, says Nordau. And because I was a Major League Dreyfusard, the secret police of France have tapped my phone and read my mail. I have no privacy. They're on my case. You don't want me being the head of a political movement when the French secret police know every one of my moves. And thirdly, I married a Shiksa. So the Orthodox are not going to go for it, and we can't alienate the Orthodox. So if it's not going to be Nordau, who would have been actually a very poor choice, I think, they had to go with somebody else. They went with David Wolfson. Why David Wolfson? Who is David Wolfson? So he was 11 years older than Herzl. He was born in 1849 in Lithuania. He had a childhood of old-line Lithuanian Orthodox Judaism, but then he moved to Cologne, and became a lumber merchant and made himself fabulously wealthy. He was a political Zionist along the lines of Herzl and a good lieutenant when Herzl was still alive. But He's a nice compromise candidate because he knows the Eastern European mindset. After all, he comes from Lithuania. And he has the religious background as opposed to the Herzl crowd who were Goyish Jews, didn't know from nothing. On that front, he's a good choice. And as for his political Zionism as opposed to synthetic or practical, he's willing to accommodate the other schools of thought. And the Presidium, or the Inner Actions Committee, which is like the Executive Committee, was now more balanced in favor of half political and half practical, basically leading to a synthetic approach. And under his watch, and he'd be the president of the movement from 1904 through 1911, when he would be basically ousted, under that term, the political approach was not about securing a charter. It was about the lesser matter of making sure the Sultan and the Ottoman regime does not ban Jewish immigration to Eretz Yisrael. That's if they tried to at various times to really cut down on it. The ability of the Ottomans to prevent immigration was not always up to the legislature or the fiat of the Sultan in Constantinople. Sometimes it had to do with the bureaucracy on the ground at the port in Haifa or in Jaffa. If you bribed the right guy, you got in. I mean, the administration was not as solid as a 21st century state. It was a bit of a hefker, free-for-all. But still, you need political agitation to make sure they don't ban immigration and they don't ban sale of land. So the sale of land and the entry of Jews into the country are the two critical factors that will be on the minds of the Zionists all the way through the 1940s, up until statehood. When we get to the white paper, those are the two factors, immigration and land purchases. But this is already starting in the 19-aughts under the Sultan. Okay. There was a moment when it was believed that an opportunity for political and diplomatic success was at hand. In 1908, 1909, you have a revolution in Turkey. Who takes over? The Young Turks. The Young Turks, okay? And they oust the Sultan in favor of his brother, who becomes the last Sultan in the chain before the Ottoman Empire disappears. And the thinking was that now you have a new administration that will be amenable to the giving of a charter. That what Herzl couldn't accomplish because up until 1904 it was impossible under Abdul Hamid II, now would be possible. That ended up being a pipe dream. As it turned out, under the Young Turks and in the subsequent administration, they were even more nationalist than previously, and no charter was at all possible. So there really was going to be no progress prior to the demise of the Ottoman Empire. Okay. Now let's get to the issue of parties within the Zionist movement. Because up until Herzl's death, you really didn't have the division of the movement into formal parties. There were moments at various of the first Zionist congresses when there was a rump faction that was angry with Herzl over something. For example, in 1901, there was the so-called Democratic faction that didn't like Herzl's heavy-handed tactics, that he was an authoritarian, and that they were more practical and he was more political. And you have in 1903 the Russian group who storms out in protest over the Ugandan East African gambit. So you have machlekes every now and then, but not formal parties. So the first one that comes on the scene is the religious Zionists. Mizrahi, Merkaz Ruchani. Merkaz Ruchani, everyone says Mizrahi was established in 1902. It's really not correct. It was actually established in 1893 and by Reb Shmuel Moylever. It was designed to be a continuation of the Chibat Zion spirit, but under specifically Orthodox auspices. Administratively, that little group was reorganized in 1902 by Rabbi Yitzchak Reines. Reines was the rabbi in Lida, and he's most famous for establishing a yeshiva that had what? Yeshiva had secular studies. Secular studies. So he was like modern Orthodox and a Zionist. That was 1905, he established the yeshiva in Lida, yeah.
So that was concurrent with New York, with the establishment of RJJ.
RJJ, yeah, around then, yeah.
Yeah.
So Merkaz Ruchani, when it was established in 1902 under Reines, was not exclusively Orthodox, actually. At first, it had a secular wing as well, and it was a protest against cultural Zionism. Why is cultural Zionism bad from an Orthodox point of view? Because the Orthodox Jews, in theory, are not supposed to be in favor of human intervention in the redemption and hastening the arrival of the Messiah. We have to have an ideology of punishment for our sins, and so we remain in the diaspora. The only justification for Orthodox participation in this venture in the early phases to cooperate with secular types like Herzl was to say that this is not the redemption, but rather this is the finding of a home for the Jewish people to escape persecution in Russia and the pogroms. So this is an Olam Hazeh kind of solution, not an Olam Haba kind of solution. You understand what I'm saying? That we have a real world problem, and the irreligious Jews and the religious Jews can gather together to find a solution to a real world problem. Not the apocalyptic, end of days scenario, return to Zion. It happens to be, we're going to go to Zion. That's going to be the solution. But not because it's Mashiach Zeit. So this is a secular Orthodox Zionism, not religious Zionism. Think of it in those terms. Secular Orthodox Zionism. By the way, would that continue into the future? And when would it stop? Who was here last year? We learned about it. Okay, the Six-Day War, before the war started, what did Chaim Moshe Shapira say about going to war and taking over the old city? He was against it. Why? Pikuach nefesh, sakanas nefashos. People could die. It's dangerous. The biggest doves, the territorial minimalists, were the Orthodox Party, NRP. Why? Because this is not messianism. Rather, this is just a home for the Jewish people in our former country, which is now a new country. It's only after the Six-Day War, and into the 1970s with Gush Emunim, that you have messianic fervor dominating religious Zionism. It goes from being secular Orthodox Zionism to truly religious Zionism, with all that entails, in terms of maximalism. But in the beginning, it wasn't that way. Okay, so I'm not saying everybody held that position. Certainly the chief rabbis didn't. Rav Kook was not of this variety. He was not like Reines and Moelever and the politicians. He was not.
Huh? That crew didn't leave Europe.
So a lot of them didn't leave Europe. You're right. You're right.
But look who went to Israel today or yesterday.
Yeah. Who went? All right.
And he's making a whole crazy
sausage. I hope he enjoys his trip. Okay. So, no, in any event, in 1903, the Orthodox Zionists, in keeping with their viewpoint that this is not messianism, but rather this is just a solution to the Jewish problem, voted with Herzl for Uganda. Can you believe that? The Frum, the one with the yarmulke on the head, voted for Uganda, and the ones with the Apikorsim voted against Uganda because it's un-Jewish. That's the state of affairs in 1903. Okay. How did it eventually develop that there's a more spiritual component towards Orthodox Zionism that is truly messianic in its character? Well, the answer to that is because the Poale Mizrahi, which was founded in the 1920s and was part of the Third Aliyah, they were more messianic in character. They had ideas about the perfect society, which would include abyssal socialism. All right, that was the forerunner of the eventual Gush Emunim, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and that crowd. But the original ones were not really messianic in character.
Yeah, okay. Wasn't Rav Kook the first father? Wasn't
yeah.
He an anchor for the movement?
No, not at all. Rav Kook was not a member of Mizrahi. Rav Kook.
I don't mean in that political sense, but in terms of ideology, in terms of giving religion a place in the governance.
So giving religion a place in society, Rav Kook was very important from his arrival in Jaffa in 1904. All the way through his death in 1935, and especially from his return from London after the end of World War I in 1919. He's appointed chief rabbi in Jerusalem and then chief rabbi of Palestine in 1921. The last decade and a half of his life, he represents Yiddishkeit to the British and to the broader yishuv. And that he did an admirable job. But on the Zionist political angle, he was not involved. He tried very briefly in 1918 to establish Degel Yerushalayim as sort of a catch-all for like an alternative to the Aguda. It fizzled out very quickly. It was nothing from nothing. Okay, so that takes care of the religious. What about labor Zionism? Where does labor Zionism come from? So the answer is that labor Zionism really is at odds with the bourgeois upper middle class Zionism of Herzl. I mean, the Herzl crowd were Western Jews with more than a few shekels in their pocket. And they were disgruntled with the inability to integrate into a Central and Western European society. They were not poor. Life was okay. It's just that residual anti-Semitism means you're never going to be fully accepted. That's a very different story from the impoverished classes in Eastern Europe who really are struggling for their daily bread and who see in socialism the solution to their problem. But how do you meld socialism with Zionism? So many would argue that you couldn't. In the earliest phases, it was ridiculed. The Social Democratic Party in Russia, which was half Jewish, okay, they would say that Zionism is a disgrace because the Zionists are distracting the masses from the real problems and real solutions that face the people. That the problems are here, and the solutions are here. The solution is not a fantasy or a utopia 2,000 miles away in the Middle East. And that to obsess over it and to spend time on it and political resources and financial resources is like a chilul not Hashem, but chilul whatever, fill in the blank. The opposite of Hashem. So who's going to do the job of combining Zionism and socialism? The answer is Nachman Sirkin, in 1898, writes the first ever such treatise, and he does his best to fit the two together. His basic argument is that the Jewish people are not going to find a home in the Social Democratic Parties of Russia because of residual anti-Semitism, and so, yes, socialism may be the solution to the ills of the various classes in society, but for our people, it isn't going to work out here. It's going to have to work out elsewhere on our terms where we're the only ones, in a homogeneous environment of Jews. And secondly, because the Jews have a distinct problem, and socialism really just solving the problem of the proletariat, but as for the middle classes, the bourgeois classes, they're actually on the negative end of the socialist agenda, well, who's going to help them? The only solution is to go to a Jewish country, presumably Eretz Israel, where even the non-proletarian Jews will find succor. So it's a nice argument, and it wins over a few people. But not everyone. Truth be told, labor Zionism was not very strong for the first, let's say, 8 or 9 years after the first Zionist Congress. It would take a doctrinaire Marxist to combine Marxism with Zionism for the masses of Eastern European Jewish radicals to be convinced that Zionism is kosher. You need Marxist Zionism, not just socialist Zionism. You got to go the distance. Who's going to do that? Be'er Borochov. Be'er Borochov is a name you never heard of, probably.
Right.
Why? Well, he died young. He was born 1881. He goes to America in 1905. He comes back to Russia in 1917 during the revolution and dies of the flu, I think, at the age of 35 or 36. So that's why he doesn't have a long, illustrious career, but his writings combining Marxism with Zionism had a tremendous impact on most of the people of the Second Aliyah. Now, who are the leaders of the Second Aliyah? Or who turns out to be famous from the Second Aliyah? Give me two names. Ben-Gurion and Ben Zvi, the Prime Minister and the Second President of Israel. So Ben-Gurion and Ben-Zvi, the big players, you know, throughout the Yishuv period and going to statehood, they were arriving on the scene in 1905, 1906.
Right. Yeah, but how many people knew what they did? You didn't hear about this before. They changed their names.
So that happens... later on. That doesn't happen right away.
Yeah, but they were the ones that...
Yes, they were insistent upon it, that you had to change your name. Well, a lot of people believed that there was a solution to the Jewish problem in Russia if only the Tsarist autocracy could be diminished, and that some representative government, some parliamentary system, would be allowed to flourish in the Romanov Russia. Well, you had a little bit of that between 1905 and 1908. In 1905, you have agitation, a little bit of a revolt, and there's elections to the Duma. And even some Jews get elected to the Duma, to the parliament. But that eventually is suppressed, and the worst agitators are jailed or exiled. So when the brief moment of optimism in Russia fades, and now it looks like there's never going to be a better day in Russia, if you were a Zionist, a socialist or Marxist, you've now given up hope on local matters, and you say, my only solution is to go to Israel. Or you weren't even a Zionist, you were just a Marxist. But it looks like the solution isn't happening anytime soon. What's the answer? Travel abroad. Go to Israel. So thousands of people who are doctrinaire socialists and Marxists go to Israel in the Second Aliyah from 1904 to 1914. How many were there? It's guesstimated that there were 30,000. How many actually stayed? Maybe 5,000. Maybe. Maybe less. People saw the conditions on the ground. They were terrible. Get on the next boat and go back. But some people stuck around. And those who stuck around established the kernel which was built up to be the basis of the yeshuv and then statehood. And next time, not tonight, but next week, we'll talk at some length about the character of the second yeshuv and the nature of the settlements that they built. Okay, but I'm here tonight just to explain that socialist Zionism is a product of its environment in Russia, and only the inability to have successful socialism, or at least it's into the future, is what causes people to look elsewhere for solutions. Okay, now, for those who were socialists but did not subscribe to Zionism, what was their option?
Bolshevism.
But what if Bolshevism was not seen as sufficiently friendly to the Jews? What is your option? Well, what if you don't want to leave? The Bund. Okay, the Arbiter Ring, the Bund. So, Jewish socialism, the Bund, really should never have come into existence, arguably. Because in socialist theory, the Jews are not a nation. The Jews lack common territory, common political entity, and to be honest, they don't even have all the same language, because although most people spoke Yiddish, there were plenty of Russified Jews and Polonized Jews. And elsewhere beyond the Tsarist Empire, Jews spoke a whole host of languages. So in socialist thinking, especially as written even later by guys like Stalin, the Jews are not a nation. They would dismiss that altogether. The Jews are just either a confessional group or an accident of history and an economic class.
What was happening, the country was running in the early 1990s.
Which country?
It was Palestine.
Yeah.
Who was doing
it?
The Ottoman Empire was in control.
And they were still in control.
They were remaining in control until
1917-18. Yeah.
Okay, so the Jews are not a nation in the eyes of the socialists. And many of the socialists were assimilationist in nature. They didn't really care to preserve the religion or the cultural life of the Jews. So in theory, if you're a secular Jewish socialist in late 1890s Russia, you should just throw your lot in with the Social Democratic Party. And plenty of Jews did that. Why does the Bund come into existence? Because sometimes the regular parties, which are heavily Gentile, are not so friendly, and some Jews feel comfortable with political agitation only among their own. Over time, the Bund would become more Jewish. And when I say more Jewish, I mean more sensitive to the cultural and even religious sensitivities of your average shtetl Jew. So by, for example, 1908, 1909, they're pressing for the right of Jewish workers to be off on Saturday. Now, the Bundist leaders couldn't care less about Shabbos, but the rank and file have a lot of people who do care about Shabbos. So they have to, over time, become more sensitive to Jewish needs. Most importantly, they want the right of Jews to speak Yiddish, that they should not be forcibly Russified. So this Bund develops an idea of diaspora nationalism, but diaspora nationalism combined with socialist ideology. What about diaspora nationalism without socialist ideology? Who's the boss of that? Anybody know? Who knows? Who wants to get the extra credit for tonight? Who's the leading ideologue of diaspora nationalism, meaning not Zionism, no to Zionism, but also no to socialism? Who's the head? Shimon Dubnov, Simon Dubnov, the historian. The historian Shimon Dubnov is a believer in the survival of Jewish identity, all right, in the Chutz La'aretz. There's no reason to go elsewhere, but we're going to stick around with our cultural baggage, linguistically, Yiddish, and even religion, if you like. He wasn't religious in the least, but if you want to preserve that, you'll preserve that too. And that the government should recognize our existence as a legitimate minority nationality, just as they would recognize all the others. Now, who are all the others?
British?
No, I mean in Eastern Europe. The Czechs, the Magyars, the Lithuanians, the Estonians, the Latvians. All these people who don't, or most of them don't, in 1900, have their own state, but are minority groups within existing states, they want their cultural prerogatives to be respected. And the Jews say, us too. Us too. We're no worse than the Poles or the Czechs, or the Lithuanians. How does this play itself out in world affairs after World War I? Who knows their history? What is a key element of Wilson's 14 points in the Versailles Treaty?
Self-determination.
So self-determination. Okay, so Wilson believes in the establishment of successor states upon the breakup of the major multinational empires. And those successor states are not ethnically homogeneous. They are heterogeneous. But the majority group runs the show. Well, what happens to the minorities? Constitutionally, they are forced to have minority clauses in the Constitution. Their president or their prime minister has to sign off on a little clause that says we're not going to bully our ethnic minorities, but rather they're going to have the rights to live their way. And what Shimon Dubnov would say is that the Jews should be no worse off than any of the other ones. We should be given our rights. Did it actually happen that way? Well, so yes, it did, officially, in almost all the successor states. But Lamaisa, as they would say, in practice, it was usually violated. In Poland, for a little while, it mattered. It actually did matter. In Lithuania, it mattered. Lithuania was the best of all of them, to be honest. In Hungary, it was terrible. In Romania, it was terrible. But sometimes the minority rights clauses actually worked, a little bit. Yeah.
Have a democratic culture.
Right, so without a democratic culture, you're at the whim of whatever guy's in charge, often a dictator, and if they don't care to protect the minorities will be bullied.
Well, that's why it worked to a great extent in Poland, because the dictator there, what was his name again?
Pilsudski. Yeah. Was relatively friendly.
Yeah. Because he had a lot to gain by it. You know, these people weren't poor.
Yeah.
They fed his beak.
So that's the story of diaspora nationalism. People who don't want to leave, and they're not socialists, but they want to maintain some Yiddishkeit. Okay. Are there any other groups out there with whom the Zionists are competing in the Jewish community for influence? Who else exists? Who have I not mentioned yet? I've mentioned the religious Zionists. I've mentioned the labor Zionists. I've mentioned the Bund. I've mentioned diaspora nationalism. Who else is there? Okay, good, yeah. Who else?
The right
wing. Huh? So the right wing doesn't exist yet. They will come to be, but mostly during the interwar period. At the period we're discussing now, I'll get to in a second what's the story with Jabotinsky at that time. But who else have I not mentioned? I haven't mentioned the Hasidim, and I haven't mentioned the assimilationists.
Well, the Middle Eastern Jews, they're not involved.
So they're not involved.
Well, they didn't get flown in yet.
The involvement of Middle Eastern Jews in Zionism is negligible before the establishment of the state. That's not to say that it's negligible in the Yishuv, in Eretz Yisrael. There's a substantial percentage of the Jews of Eretz Yisrael are of Middle Eastern extraction. And it would grow tremendously in 1949, 1950, when the whole Middle East Jewry gets evacuated and goes to Israel. But before the state, as a political matter, they're really not involved. Okay, so I haven't mentioned the assimilationists. Who are they? Who are these people? The answer is, not everyone in the Jewish fold is interested in preserving Jewish identity in the long run. Some people regarded the baggage of Jewish identity as being just that, baggage, and nothing better. Not something you would want to retain long term. And so what's the solution? Blend in. Such people existed in Russia since the days of the Eastern European Haskalah. And even though there were pogroms, there were still Jews who were Russophiles and believed in integration and thought that the solution is we just won't be Jewish anymore. In Poland, such people existed. Certainly in Germany, such people existed. I mean, in Western Europe for sure. But even in Eastern Europe, there were people who believed the solution is be like everybody else and abandon all forms of cultural distinctiveness. So what is the Zionist counter-argument to the assimilationists? What is the counter-argument? Twofold.
Well, it doesn't work. We'll never let them be assimilationists.
Okay, good. Good. So number one, that it's embarrassing. It's a disgrace. That you have to have a certain self-pride and to be interested in self-abnegation to such an extent as to erase your past is like a shanda. That's point number one. And it's a fair point, but it's one that if you don't agree with it, you don't agree with it. So the second point is that the assimilationist agenda will not work. That it has been tried unsuccessfully since the beginnings of the modern period in Western Europe, and since the 1870s, 80s, 90s in Eastern Europe, and with a checkered record. It simply hasn't worked all that well. So,
what do you attribute that to? Is it because you got to assimilate in the religious sense?
Okay, I'll tell you what I think it is. Number one, you have basic anti-Semitism that isn't interested in the Jews joining the majority group.
Not even if they would convert to Christianity?
Maybe then, but probably not even then. Certainly in Germany, conversion didn't matter. That's a racial issue. In Eastern Europe, maybe conversion would help, but maybe. The other issue is, if not everyone assimilates, then the assimilationists automatically are wrong. Assimilationists are only right if everybody goes along for the ride and Jewry disappears. But so long as not everyone agrees with them among our fold, they're only a 10%, 20%, whatever it is, whatever percentage, if the vast bulk of Jewry don't drop their cultural distinctiveness, then it doesn't matter that a handful did. The Jews as a conglomerate are still visible, and the old hatreds and biases will remain. So for the assimilationists to be successful, they'd have to be 100% successful, and they're nowhere close to that. Therefore, it's a failure. Okay. The other thing is, the Zionists would argue that assimilation works at the individual level, maybe, but at the national level, it cannot work. You're never going to get unanimity on on the agenda for the future, and since you're not going to get that unanimity, we will still have people who look Jewish, who smell Jewish, who taste Jewish, and all of our troubles will remain, will not be eliminated. Okay, that's a very potent Zionist counter-argument to assimilation. By the way, let's now go to where the opposite holds true, where the Zionists would have to have a different strategy vis-a-vis assimilation, the United States of America. In the United States, it's the one place on earth, where assimilation is possible not only at the individual level, but at a mass level, where the vast bulk of the people throw off the yoke of tradition and no longer have the trappings of Jewish culture. So, if anything, the worry is how will we sustain Jewish life, not how can we subvert Jewish life. So, where does Zionism fit in that equation? In the words of Solomon Schechter, Zionism is a bulwark against assimilation. Truer words were never spoken. How is that the case? Think about in this country, throughout the 20th century, but especially the first half of the 20th century, and probably into the first decade or two of Israel's existence as a state, what percentage of American Jews were scrupulously observant of the mitzvot in the traditional sense? Very few. But what percentage of American Jews had a concern in their heart and their kishkas for the fate of the yeshuv and for Zionism? A tremendous number. Yeah. Tremendous number. Such that in the post-1948 era, what is the civic religion of American Judaism? Two things. Holocaust and the State of Israel. So Holocaust is a sad thing, but we wish it didn't happen. On the positive side of things, only the State of Israel. So people, their Jewish attachments were preserved by Zionism and Philo-Israelism, or pro-Israelism, post-48. Schechter, in 1905, made that comment. So the same year that David Wolfson is taking over for Herzl, and Zionism is really at a standstill and has not achieved very much, already Solomon Schechter is saying, this will be the salvation for the Yiddishkeit of a lot of American Jews. He was quasi-Navua when he said that. But oh, he moves to Israel in the 1890s.
I know, but
actually in the 1880s.
Yeah, but he was a strong advocate.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. Well, we're going to get to that in a second, but the advance of Hebrew. But when Solomon Schechter spoke favorably about Zionism in 1905, what were the professional consequences that he faced? You remember? We spoke about this maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah, I don't fault you for forgetting. It's been a while. So who was the who were the board chairman and trustees of the Jewish Theological Seminary in the post-1902 era?
Louis Finkelstein? Or that
no. He's the chancellor in 1940 and onward. But who's the lay leadership that took over the old seminary and made the new seminary in 1902? What persuasion of Jews were they?
Reform.
Reform. Bingo. And not just reform.
Reform to make that reform. They wanted to make sure that was a steady,
good,
very modern, traditional.
Good. But what was their attitude on Zionism? Anti. Very anti. So they threatened to fire him for his pro-Zionist orientation. But he was a tough dude. And he said, I don't care what you say. Too bad. You need me more than I need you. And so he allowed Zionist activity and clubs among the student body at JTS, which, by the way, was very important because among the leadership of the Zionist Organization of America in the pre-state era, who was most prominently represented? Conservative rabbis. I mean, yes, there are exceptions. The two major exceptions are the two leaders, Stephen Wise and Abba Hillel Silver, but among the next ranking crowd, they were all conservative rabbis, like Israel Goldstein. Okay, so the fate of Zionism in America was in the hands of really the clergy, but they understood it was a way of preventing assimilation. Now, what about elsewhere in the world, in the first decade of the 20th century, how is Zionism faring? So even though politically there had been almost no success, the popularity of Zionism in Russia only grows and grows and grows. And the number of shekel payers increases and increases and increases to 127,000 by 1914. So why, in the absence of political success, does the Zionist organization retain its popularity around the world and especially in Eastern Europe? Why? Because all the reasons why Zionism was started in the first place are still there. All the problems have not gone away. the fact that the solution has proven to not be much of a solution doesn't mean you're not going to keep trying, because the problems are still problems. That's a very important point, maybe the most important point of this whole lecture tonight, is that Zionism is a solution, a posited, a theorized solution to the Jewish question in Eastern Europe, I mean the world over, but especially Eastern Europe, and because it's the most logical solution, arguably, or the one that appeals to the inner feelings of the Jew more than any other, it will continue to exist even in the absence of success, because people want it to be successful. There's a will to succeed, and that will push it forward even without any hatzlacha, any real gains. Okay. What about elsewhere in the world? So, in Germany, Zionism remains a fairly fringe phenomenon. The German Jews never go whole hog for Zionism. However, Wolfson is able to attract some big names among German Jewry to Zionism, including Kurt Blumenfeld, Otto Warburg, who would eventually become the next president of the Zionist organization, and Albert Einstein. Yeah.
Oh, later on, Louis Brandeis.
So we'll get to that in America. In America, Louis Brandeis comes on the scene in 1914, and well, I might as well talk about it now. So Brandeis was really not involved in Yiddishkeit at all. He was from far, not an eastern coastal city. He was from, I think, Kentucky. What was that?
Louisville.
From Louisville. And he, they say that his family was a Frankist family, that his great-granddaddy was a follower of Jacob Frank. Oh, yeah, Baruch is right. We shouldn't know from Jacob Frank. But Brandeis was attracted to Zionism as philanthropy, really. Not for the Jews of America, who don't need a refuge. They're in their own refuge. America's a wonderful place. But for those people who need a refuge, who are currently living under oppression in foreign countries, they shall be going to Eretz Yisrael. What Brandeis did by his taking on the leadership of the Federation of American Zionists was to give respectability to the movement among the upper crust Jews who otherwise would have vacillated or hesitated. The lower class, the R student, the East Side Jews, they were perfectly fine supporting Zionism from the beginning. But if you were already an acculturated American Jew, if Brandeis says it's okay, that means that it's okay. And it also means that in the halls of power in Washington, there's going to be somebody with access who supports these ideas that will prove relevant in the Balfour era in 1917. But important to realize about American Zionism, America is the New World, the Wild West. And the colonists and the pioneers, the frontiersmen, they are the heroes. Who's the bad guy? The Indians.
Right, the Indians.
Okay? So Zionism was seen as a replica of America. That the Jews, the Zionists, the Chalutzim, are the frontiersmen, and the Arabs are like the Native American Indians. And so this is in an era before we had political sensitivities like we have today. This was espoused as a reason to support Zionism, that it is just like the situation in America. Now think about this a little bit further. If you go back to, let's say, the days of George Washington and his letter to the Newport Hebrew congregation, and the whole history of early American Judaism, America was seen as the new Zion. Now Zion is seen as the new America. But flip it around. How do you like that? Okay. Well, that takes care of geographically the issues of Zionism. Now, at the biennial Zionist congresses, it used to be that people were divided along geographic lines. There would be X number of representatives from this country, from that country. There were the Russian Zionists, the American Zionists, the German. That will continue to exist, simply because geography never goes away. But as the partification of Zionism develops, there are parties, religious, general, socialist, right-wing, that will come to dominate much more so than geography. Geography will take a back seat to ideology as the decades move along. Okay. Now, the last thing I want to discuss tonight is the the right wing. So there is no right wing in the early phases. You could say from an economic point of view, there are the non-socialists. The non-socialists. Are they necessarily laissez-faire capitalists? Probably. But economic theory is not their focus. And in fact, they'd be very proud of the fact that economic theory is not their focus. But rather, they are monists. What is monism? Where you have one focus and one focus only. And what is that? Zionism. Unadulterated Zionism. Without it being gemished with economic theory or religious theory. So, who are these people? Well, that's Herzl. Herzl would say, don't distract me with your economic theories and your religious theories. We're just going to go forward, plow forward political Zionism. So, the successors to Herzl don't have a party affiliation. Now, that's going to turn out to be a problem. Because if you don't have a party affiliation, in an era when parties are now coming to dominate the Zionist congresses, you will lose your power, your grip on power. What ultimately becomes of these non-socialist, non-religious Zionists? What name do we give them? So if you paid attention last year, we discussed this at great length. A party that I was pretty fond of. General Zionism. Not general like General Grant or General Lee, but general Zionism, generic Zionism. So there's a problem with general Zionism. It's like conservative Judaism. It's neither here nor there. It's not Orthodox, it's not Reform. You know, it's an ideology by the absence of an ideology. You're defining yourself by what you're not. And that doesn't go a very long way. So general Zionism struggled to develop a base of mass support. The advantage that they had was that the leadership was almost always from their ranks, namely Herzl, Wolfson, Warburg later on, and then Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann, we're going to spend a bunch of weeks discussing Weizmann, but he's the boss of the movement from 1920 officially, but even before that unofficially, to 1931, and then 1935 to 1946. So for almost the whole British Mandate era, Chaim Weizmann is the president of the Zionist organization. What party is he from? He's not a socialist. He's not a religious. He's not a hardline right-winger either. In fact, he's very much opposed to the right-wing. He's a general Zionist. But even that, he doesn't like to be associated with. He's not a party man. He's above all the parties. Yeah, you had a question.
The point is that you don't have a power base if you're a general Zionist,
right.
But you also don't have all those people who hate you because of a different philosophy.
Right, so you're able to cooperate.
If you're a good leaguer, you can bring it together.
Right, so the advantage of general Zionism is your ability to operate with, in conjunction with, people of all stripes.
Yeah, but wasn't he the one that would facilitate the Balfour Declaration?
Correct, that is true.
You can't lose under those circumstances.
Okay.
So
he's a Russian-born Jew who is educated in Switzerland, and he goes on to become a scientist and lives in England in Manchester, and eventually moves to Eretz Yisrael to Rehovot, where you have the Weizmann Institute, and he's the leading diplomat. He's If David Ben-Gurion is the boss on the ground in Israel for a while, Weizmann is the broader emissary of Am Yisrael to the world for a good 30 years. So I bring up his name just because he represents that faction.
He became the first president.
And becomes the first president. So when Israel ends up becoming a state, or actually even before statehood, general Zionism is split in half. General Zionists A and General Zionists B. A was more favorably inclined towards the policies of the labor movement. They weren't socialists, but they had an affinity for the wing of the Yishuv, which was labor Zionist. And B was for more the property owners and the bourgeois types and the handful of wealthy people who existed in the Yishuv. That on issues of social class, general Zionism would divide between A and B. But they would also divide on issues of the aggressive nature of diplomacy. General Zionism of Weizmann has a moderate attitude in diplomacy. Let's be civil, let's talk nicely to the British, they're our friends, they'll do us good, blah, blah, blah. The hardline right says, we don't trust anybody, nobody is our friend, and we have to be more assertive in making our demands. That's a Jabotinsky approach. Already in 1902, at the age of 22 years old, Jabotinsky is at the Zionist Congress and meets Herzl, and Herzl like dismisses him with a wave of a hand. So their full interaction was like 5 seconds. Who is this young kid? It turned out he became a big man. But Herzl did meet Jabotinsky for 5 seconds. And Jabotinsky was, we'll discuss him at length at some point, a respected mainstream Zionist leader, part of the executive, part of the team. He would not break from the ranks until the 1920s, until 1925 when he establishes the Revisionist Party, until 1934-5 when he establishes the new Zionist organization. So there is a right wing, but in the early phases it hardly exists and is subsumed in the general camp, as opposed to the religious or the labor. Okay, so with this we'll stop. And next time, we're going to spend the whole session on what really happened in Eretz Yisrael during the Second Aliyah. What was life like in the Kvutzot, the original collectivist settlements? What was happening with Hebrew as opposed to Yiddish, or as opposed to German, in the language wars? And what's happening in the realm of religion? Is there cooperation or antagonism between the old yeshuv, and for that matter, the religious elements of the new yeshuv, and people who are thoroughly secular? We'll see you next week.